February 11th. I don't know, about 2-3 months ago, I was at a very interesting task force or a meeting out in Bloomington on fraud, and I thought it was very informational, and it brought me up to speed on a lot of things in this area, and I thought we'd have a kind of a condensed version of that insurance fraud meeting that I attended a while back. So that's what we're here for today. Very, very important issue for this committee. I've heard said, and I know it's factual, but there's 10 to 15% of our premiums are due to fraud. So this is a very good topic for this committee to dig into. How far we're going to go this session, I don't know, but we are going to look at it quite heavily, I think, during the interim and come back with some recommendations for the next session. With that, Commissioner Rothman, welcome to the committee, and I heard your presentation that day, and you were pretty good. you were very good. I could only stay to about 11 o'clock, but you were up, I think, about 9 o'clock, and you were awake, and you did a wonderful job. So welcome to the Commerce Committee. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Metzen and members of the Commerce Committee, for asking me to be here today. It's a pleasure. I will talk about some of the stuff we talked about that day, as well as some others, to give you an update on where we are with the department and insurance fraud matters. For the record, again, I am Mike Rothman, the Commerce Commissioner. Today's hearing on insurance fraud prevention is timely. Today kicks off the 2013 Insurance Fraud Awareness Week. The Insurance Fraud Week is designed to raise community awareness of insurance fraud occurrences, to create more widespread public knowledge of insurance fraud program in Minnesota and its purpose, and to educate Minnesotans to take responsibility in the prevention of insurance fraud. So this Wednesday, on February 13th, a couple days from now, I will be hosting an insurance fraud roundtable along with our insurance fraud division and many of the folks here in the room. The event will take place at the Department of Commerce. It'll follow up on the summit, Mr. Chair, that you had talked about. And the focus and purpose is to gather folks together, federal, state, and local law enforcement, the insurance industry, and trade associations, to identify the ways that we can strengthen our work together to prevent and tackle insurance fraud. The roundtable will focus on the steps to better coordinate our insurance fraud prevention and enforcement strategies. We will be focusing on current fraud issues, strengthening the partnership, and enhancing the ways in which we communicate with each other.
Yeah.
The insurance fraud roundtable and our efforts to stop insurance fraud itself fit with the Commerce Department's overall mission and our priorities. As you are all well aware from the previous comments I made in the testimony here in the committee, the Department of Commerce impacts nearly all aspects of Minnesota's economy and its financial, energy, and telecommunications sectors. With such a versatile role, the Commerce Department is uniquely positioned in with the resources we have. We've identified a mission-driven responsibility to proactively educate and engage Minnesotans, both consumers and the industries we regulate. Since day one on the job as commissioner, my team and I have worked to build partnerships with stakeholders in a wide range of critical issues such as financial literacy, elder fraud, predatory lending, and other consumer protection initiatives. We've worked hard to build these relationships, and in particular, insurance fraud prevention. My staff and I have conducted meetings on how to join forces to prevent and prosecute insurance fraud and other criminal activities with our partners, including county attorneys. Particularly, I met with Ramsey County Attorney John Choi. I came over to the office. He and I spoke, and we talked about how we can collaborate, in particular on insurance fraud, and I know you'll be hearing from him later today. I also met with Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, and a large, as you'll see, we'll talk about one of the large cases that we dealt with. We worked on together.
that's it.
We have sheriffs. We worked with sheriffs and police. We worked with U.S. Attorney's Office. We've worked with special investigation units of insurance companies, other social service agencies in Minnesota, and federal and other federal and state agencies. It was a high priority for me, and the meetings served a dual purpose. First, to personally articulate to our law enforcement stakeholders a strong leadership and a change in direction at the Department of Commerce, and particularly in our insurance fraud division in these matters. I take the work we do seriously, and while I'm a commissioner, I have a not on my watch philosophy. For criminals perpetrating insurance fraud scams against Minnesota consumers or businesses, the department will use all available resources to prevent and investigate these crimes. Second, to ask our partners in law enforcement how we can better work together to leverage our resources to combat insurance fraud and raise awareness, including outreach efforts to our county attorneys, local police departments across the state, and how we can work together to combine our available resources to investigate these crimes. Let me give you an overview of our insurance fraud division. The Department of Commerce has detectives and analysts serving the public on insurance fraud scams. The Division of Insurance Fraud Prevention was created by the state legislature in 2004. We have worked to build effective partnerships with our local law enforcement agencies, special investigation units at insurance companies that report insurance fraud, and other agencies. Last year, I chose Bob Hearns to lead the Insurance Fraud Division. Bob is here with us today, and what a terrific choice he has turned out to be for me. Bob brought a stellar career in public service, more than 35 years of experience in law enforcement, including a major stint as the Golden Valley Public Safety Director. From day one, Bob Hearns hit the ground running. I charged him with the responsibility to revitalize the Insurance Fraud Division unit, his work to build those partnerships I talked about, and to help reorganize the division so that we can be more effective. The reorganization, including making sure that our detectives were organized well. We now have two strong supervisors. They work to assemble the evidence, prepare charges, and assist law enforcement. The IFD, the fraud division, has focused on cases that will result in charges, specifically those that will be picked up by prosecutors. The division looks at all the referrals closely to ensure that it has the evidence to meet the charges, that it has the evidence so that it can charge at a criminal conduct standard. Finally, the division is looking at ways to proactively rather than reactively employ new technology in the investigations that they do. So let me talk a little bit about the impact or the responsibilities of the Insurance Fraud Division. These are largely by statute, but also some of the focus that they do. They review the insurance fraud reports that come into the unit. They respond to complaints of any suspected insurance fraud that are referred to us. They initiate investigations when they have reason to believe there's been fraud conducted. They refer alleged insurance fraud cases to appropriate law enforcement, assembling evidence, helping prepare charges. They go out on warrants, help arrest criminals, and assist other law enforcement agencies in any way that they can. Question comes up about what is insurance fraud? What are we talking about? From across the country and in Minnesota, many of these insurance fraud scams, at the heart of them, start as either arson or some sort of auto claim, property damage, falsification. They include workers' compensation fraud, homeowners fraud, health care fraud, life insurance fraud. The cases can be quite fascinating, interesting, but also fundamentally dangerous at their core. People also issue fake insurance policies. They also pocket premiums, and our folks help investigate that conduct. The impact, or excuse me, the impact of insurance fraud is in a large scale put here in place in terms of what it is that we're dealing with in terms of dollars. You had indicated at the top, Mr. Chair, that it does have an impact on insurance premiums, and it goes into the stream there. Well, the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud estimates that fraud costs insurance carriers and consumers in the United States, not this isn't Minnesota, but all over the country, nearly $80 billion a year. The costs average out to roughly $950 per family in the United States. It contributes to higher insurance premiums. The insurers pass the costs of bogus claims on to policyholders, spreading those costs. And the direct and indirect costs of insurance fraud are nearly impossible to calculate, but for sure will result in higher premiums. But a particular concern is the fact that people's lives are put in danger through staged auto accidents, fake insurance claims, sometimes arson, and sometimes for life insurance premiums. Unlike perpetrators of other crimes, people who commit insurance fraud are not easily distinguishable and share no special demographic or psychological characteristics. But it is a crime that's being perpetrated by opportunistic by individuals both inside and outside of the insurance industry. So let me talk a little bit about specific examples that the insurance fraud has worked on, some of the stories that give you an idea of the work that we have done at the Department of Commerce. Without a doubt, the investigations by our detectives have stopped criminals. Over the past 2 years, the Insurance Fraud Division has successfully conducted investigations of insurance fraud, resulting in very high-profile arrests and convictions. So let me take an opportunity to walk through some of those to highlight some of our bigger cases. Let me start with mortgage planners, or sometimes MPI. The couple at the heart of this criminal scam were James and Wendy Ober. Last year, Commerce Department worked in partnership with Hennepin County Attorney's Office in bringing racketeering charges against mortgage planners and this couple and the people that worked with them. The process that ultimately resulted in felony charges against these four individuals started by a tip to our investigators received from a closing company. The tip led to the Department of Commerce's investigation into title insurance scams and mortgage-related underlying issues. It led to uncovering a $10 million mortgage scam. Stolen and fictitious identities were used in some transactions. In others, they used straw buyers to purchase homes, mostly taking advantage of homeless or unemployed individuals. The couple pleaded guilty to criminal charges and received 10 years in prison. It was interesting. Let me tell you how they perpetrated a lot of the scams. Can we go to this slide here? This is a picture of a cell phone used by the Obers. You can see the numbers there. They're correlated with the name of a fictitious employer. And so when a straw buyer had made an application for a mortgage, they had put in their employment and verification information and these phone numbers. The phone numbers always led to the same person. And whenever the phone rang, the Obers knew who was calling, and it would show for which fictitious employer. They'd get on the phone and verify that the straw buyer was employed when, in fact, they were not. Again, as I indicated, in the end, MPI obtained over $10 million in fraudulent loans obtained. Worked closely with Hennepin County attorney. It was a classic case of insurance fraud that displayed the incredible lengths that criminals will take to commit insurance fraud. Next, let me talk to you a little bit and share the story of the beatdown posse. When I first started as commissioner, I was briefed on this case by our detectives. Fundamentally, it turned out that this was a gang in North Minneapolis that had been operating Gustafson's Bail Bond Surety Company, a company licensed by the Department of Commerce. But its name came from the fact that that this was a group of individuals led by Joe Gustafson and Joe Gustafson Jr., who would, in essence, bond out or bail bond out criminals. And these criminals would go out. They'd be released from jail. The Gustafsons would then go after them and take their go after their drugs, weapons, and actually beat them up, which is the reason why they were called the Beatdown Posse. They had terrorized North Minneapolis residents for over two decades. It was an organization that regularly kidnapped and beat people up. It was one of North Minneapolis's most notorious and violent gangs. But for all the heinous activities, it was insurance fraud that was their Achilles heel. The Beatdown Posse used straw buyers and phony employment information on mortgage forms to illegally obtain mortgages to purchase foreclosed properties. They would use the properties for growing illicit drugs. And following the purchase of the properties and the growing of the drugs, they would burn them down, burn the houses down, commit arson, and then submit the claims to collect insurance. That act led to our investigators in the Division of the Insurance Fraud to receive some of the first tips that ended and resulted in six felony charges against these individuals. The Joe Gustafson Jr. was charged at the beginning of April, led by his father. They both received 15 years in prison, a $300,000 fine, and I wanted to reference this story in particular because of how effectively the department worked to investigate this, work with the investigators, and show the specialized detective work and analysis that our unit can do to bring criminals to justice. Whether you are a state, local, or federal agency, our investigators in the division will work with you and to apply all of the tools we have to help take on criminal activity. The next one is a most recent example. 2 weeks ago, the Insurance Fraud Division closed a joint multi-month investigation with the Minneapolis Park Police. Dave Juntinen is the owner of Top Gear Auto Works in Minneapolis. It repaired and restored high-end luxury and sport cars, and with Pamela Jean DuPont, who's 41 years old, they were both charged with insurance fraud and unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. According to the criminal complaint, Jundin agreed in late 2011 to store two cars for customers. He then took them out on March 28, took one of them out. It was a 2007 Lamborghini Gallardo without asking for permission. The Fridley police picked up the car in a traffic. It was out on another traffic stop. Saw their Lamborghini drive past at an enormous high speed. The Lamborghini struck three trees and two light poles and tore up the turf at Nelson Park, BF Nelson Park in northeast Minneapolis. Juntin and DuPont drove the heavily damaged car from the crash site, but eventually called for a tow truck. Later that same day, Juntin filed an insurance claim against Top Gears, his company's commercial liability insurance policy, to repair the car's damage, estimated at $82,000. Within days, Minneapolis Park Police had figured out that the accident at the park involved a Lamborghini, and an investigator interviewed both of these individuals. Later in the month, working with the insurance company investigator, our folks, or detectives, interviewed these individuals. They were given statements, including the claim that the accident occurred at a different time, but we concluded that they had engaged in insurance fraud. The investigation led to them making incriminating statements to the owner of the Lamborghini last month. As the criminal complaint states, Juntin told the owner that if he went back to the insurance company asking them again to pay, based on the statements I gave, I'm going to prison. In essence, the conduct that this represents is a small example, a big example of a lot of small activity that happens throughout with respect to insurance fraud. Mr. Chair, as you can see, I want to show you the success of our unit. It day-to-day brings in a lot of casework, a lot of referrals. I asked this morning and found out that the number of cases that our caseload has, that we've had referrals from to our agency and the work that we're doing is, in 2012, picked up. It's twice that of what it was in 2011, excuse me. And the work that we're doing is to continue to work to prosecute, to investigate, to lead to, again, as I indicated, cases that can be charged at a criminal level conduct. I want to close by thanking you again, Mr. Chair, for inviting me here today. It's important because Minnesotans are lucky because they have a coalition like this one working to protect communities across our state. I want to make sure my comments are known and that they're in particularly limited to insurance fraud and the work that we're doing at the Department of Commerce. We feel that the only way we can truly succeed is the effective cooperation and strong partnerships that we have with our respective agencies, law enforcement, and the insurance industry. Without a collaborative effort and a sincere commitment to tangible partnerships, we will never be able to stop to this degree, the large number of pervasive problems in Minnesota. As the governor's office indicates, the governor's office, there's a sign that it indicates, and it says that none of us is as smart as all of us. And keeping with that spirit, Mr. Chair, we work collaboratively with all of our all of these folks, and are very pleased with the outcome that we have with our insurance fraud division. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd leave it at that. A presentation, if there are any questions or not, I'm happy to stand for any questions. But
any questions again, at this time of the commissioner? If not, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, do you ever get reparations or any compensation from any of these folks? And what's the degree of that? And what I'm looking for is how much is it costing to go after these people? And how often do you or how much do you retrieve from them?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, in this area, this is criminal activity. So ultimately, once we investigate the conduct, it'll get turned over to the prosecutors to prosecute. When they prosecute, part of their work that they would do would include whether or not they would seek the reparations from those folks, from the criminals to the victims. And they often do and often can try to get those reparations. And we encourage it at every opportunity that we can. The amount that this takes really goes to the budget. And I believe that with the limited amount of budget that we have, you can see, given the big cases that we're able to tackle that and the good work that our folks do in this area, that it's well worth it to get to the outcomes that we can do.
I think, Senator Carlson, were you kind of going at this from whether his department is remunerated or getting some money for what they're doing? And,
Mr. Chair,
or
yes.
Just the victims. I think you meant also
correct
the commissioner's office if they were
yes, Mr.
reimbursed.
Chair, looking at it appears like the amount of money that's put into the budget for this is really a sunk cost, and anything comes back to other individuals or other departments or the victims themselves.
Yeah. Well, it is a state function, and we should be doing this, obviously. But but I think you're kind of onto something there. But okay, I think Mr. Choi or John, I didn't see you here. How's my friend? I haven't seen you for a while. Good to see you, Mr.
Good to be here, Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
and great to see you, and great to be here with all of the members of the Senate Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney, and I want to first of all thank you, Mr. Chairman, for inviting me here today, along with our great Commerce Commissioner, Mike Rothman, who I want to just have a brief shout-out for, who I believe has just been a really wonderful partner in all of this. I think a big part of going after financial fraud, insurance fraud, is about being intentional about this. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the trends that we're seeing, but I think you'll see that the Department of Commerce, through the changes that they have made a huge impact, and we certainly feel it from a prosecution standpoint because more cases are being referred to our office, and all of that starts with the investigative agency. And as it relates to financial fraud and insurance fraud, that starts with the Department of Commerce. So I just want to recognize his leadership and also the work that Bob Hearns has been doing with respect to the investigations of this crime. One of my top priorities as the Chief Prosecutor in Rams County is to focus on financial fraud. And, of course, that includes, among other things, insurance fraud. In June of 2011, I created a financial fraud unit within my office to focus on this growing area of concern that I see as the Chief Prosecutor in Ramsey County. One of the trends that I see is that the criminal enterprise of defendants who are coming through the criminal justice system is changing. And I think one of the things that we need to recognize is that a lot of these violent criminals, people engaged in organized crime, are shifting from dealing drugs or committing acts of violence to committing acts of financial fraud. And I have not seen it in the context of insurance fraud, but I think we should be recognizing this shift that I see with respect to the activities of some of these criminals around financial fraud activities. And what concerns me about all of that is that in order to commit these acts of financial fraud, what these criminals need are people's identities. And that is, in many ways, the yeast to bake the bread. And so when we're talking about this broad concept of financial fraud, I see more and more victims because there's a need to get people's Social Security numbers, their personal information to commit these acts of financial fraud. And then, of course, in the insurance context, what concerns me is that as this area is growing because we're being more intentional about all of this and uncovering these things, is that at the end of the day, we, the public, we all end up paying in terms of higher premiums and things of that sort as consumers of insurance. But we also have some challenges with respect to being very intentional about financial fraud and insurance fraud. I think one of the things is the lack of resources from an investigative and a prosecution standpoint. I've been able to dedicate one prosecutor. Commerce has been very intentional about having their investigators go after this, but I think there really is a need to have more investigation, more prosecution along this area because, again, this area I see a kind of a criminal enterprise shift of criminals who are engaged in dealing drugs moving into this particular area. And I think they do that because they recognize that the chances of them being caught are a lot less. And if they do, the penalties are going to be less severe. And so I think that's something that we should also be mindful of. Another thing, too, is that just the way that because of the lack of resources, I find a lot of times in investigations and in prosecution, we have to delineate these artificial lines. So, for instance, a referral to a federal agency for prosecution in the financial fraud context, oftentimes we will see that those cases can't be prosecuted by the United States government because they can't take the cases involving the smaller matters. They have certain thresholds that they can only take, and I think the criminals know that. And we also have distinctions between misdemeanor crimes and felony crimes. And a lot of times you can almost see it as these cases are being presented to our office that the defendants, they kind of know these distinctions. And they also know that while the criminal justice system thinks in a jurisdictional standpoint, there's differences between city attorneys and county attorneys. There's differences between jurisdictions, between federal government and the state and state prosecution. And a lot of times we see a lot of these cases being presented, and you can almost see that the defendants, they know the difference, the distinction between what is a felony and what isn't a felony. And you see it kind of play out in terms of a lot of times the financial fraud that we see is kind of across the board in the metropolitan area, and they will do their crimes throughout the region instead of just in one particular area. With respect to the numbers, in terms of financial fraud, and I talked a little bit about the identity theft, how that's the yeast to bake this bread, And this, I think, is a lot to do with some of the law enforcement in our community being much more intentional about going after fraud. But, you know, we've seen an increase in 2010, you know, in terms of theft by swindle. We have increased from 157 to 184 in the amount of defendants that have charged. Identity theft has increased from 14 cases or 7 cases last year to 23 cases in the past year. And then also with respect to insurance fraud, and this is a credit to the Commerce Department, but for the years 2008 and 2011, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office received one referral for criminal prosecution during those years. Because of Mike Rothman's leadership and his work in trying to be intentional about this, in just last year alone, we prosecuted 6 criminal defendants, and I expect that number to increase with the attention that's been given at Commerce with respect to insurance fraud. And then, you know, the types of insurance fraud cases that we get, the commissioner talked about them, it runs the whole gamut to people who are committing acts of arson, rogue contractors, people who are making false claims, who are trying to increase the claim that they make fraudulently, or just making up claims. In fact, we just had a case involving in this past year in 2012 where people were just basically faking injuries and they were submitting disability payments to Aflac Insurance Company. And because of the work of the Commerce Department and our office, we were able to bring justice to that case and hold those defendants accountable. And I guess I want to end with respect to my comments and remarks about that call for if there's a possibility that the legislature could think about adding more resources for investigation and prosecution across the board. And I think one possibility that I'd ask this committee and this body to look at is to look at the auto theft prevention surcharge. There's a dollar that's allocated that's taken from policyholders who pay auto theft premiums, and essentially it's a dollar a year, but half of that goes back to the general fund. Over time, that money has been taken out of that fund, but I think this would be a great opportunity if there's a financial possibility and a will to start looking at re-diverting that money that's going to the general fund back into its intended purpose, which is for auto theft, but I think the scope of that fund could increase to include insurance fraud. And if there's a way to fund more investigators and prosecutors, I think that would be very welcome from my perspective. And with that, I'll conclude.
I was around when we did that, and that was earmarked for fraud. And then because of budget constraints, we stole that money like we did some other funds along the way.
Yeah.
But I think we ought to get back on track, and that's why we did that. And then we took the money away. So we got to look at that and probably fix that up. Any questions, Mr. Choi? Thank you very much for appearing here this morning. And Bob Johnson, Bradley Doty, and Tim Lynch, did you want to come up at the same time? Is that what the program is? And always identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll start off, and
sure,
we'll work together here. Mr. Chairman and committee members, it's a pleasure to be here today. And I want to, first off, just publicly thank and acknowledge the work of Commerce Commissioner Mike Rothman and Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, and frankly, with the renewed energy and attention and focus and resources and collaboration that is underway right now. And we needed that in Minnesota. I think with the hire by Commissioner Rothman and Bob Hearns, it's just been a change of scenario. I was here when the fraud unit was passed. I was part of that effort to pass it and fund it. And frankly, it's just it needed to happen. It's happened. Both of Commissioner Rothman and Mr. Choi spoke at that fall summit that you referenced, Mr. Chairman. We were one of the co-sponsors of that. And I think from our industry's perspective, I just wanted to say that publicly because it's important, and we look forward to the future collaborative efforts, not only with Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, but other county attorneys and Hennepin County Attorney There's just been a renewed focus, and I think the meeting that Commissioner Rothman is hosting on Wednesday and inviting a broad spectrum of the public and private sector to continue that collaborative efforts is essential. I think the title of the hearing, Mr. Chairman, the impact of insurance fraud on Minnesota consumers, really, Mr. Rothman put a slide up that gave us the impact of fraud and talked about the $950 a year per family impact and increased premiums and the cost of goods and services. But that's the dollars, and I guess to the extent you can measure the dollars, but insurance fraud also often imposes physical, psychological, and emotional costs upon individuals and families that you can't put a price tag on. So I think from our perspective, this is a crime that's worth fighting and it's worth the attention and the resources. I think from an insurance industry perspective, the primary tool that the insurance companies will use to in this fight against fraud, most companies will have and operate what's called special investigative units. You've heard reference to the SIUs. So companies staff their special investigative unit departments with clinical, medical, statistical, law enforcement, prosecutor resources to have the expertise within the companies in terms of the range of tasks that they do in investigating claims, coordinating with law enforcement and prosecutors, training in-house personnel in terms of identifying fraud, developing and using sophisticated software and new tools in terms of the detection of fraud, initiating civil actions, and as has been described to you, insurance companies are obligated under Minnesota law, and we have supported the passage of the laws that are found in a number of areas. Insurance companies are obligated to report to law enforcement, to designated government officials, instances of suspected or alleged fraud. So it's a requirement in terms of operations that we do that communication. And insurers are obligated to develop anti-fraud plans. So there's a number of tools, and we as an industry have through the years supported the passage of those tools into law in terms of dealing with the issue. I think as Mr. Choi commented on, that we know that fraudsters, those engaged in these issues, they can change their tactics. They can be mobile, elusive, and innovative. So the fraudsters out there often are good at what they do. And so, again, it requires that commitment and the collaborative public-private partnership to get at that. Mr. Chairman, I have a handout that should be in your packet that I'll just briefly walk through. Because the other thing that I wanted to do, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is just kind of give a snapshot of some of the current efforts, activities, laws, and some prospects to deal with this problem in society. And as that handout, the first one, it has the NICB Insurance Federation. I just wanted the committee members to see. We can't replay that full day summit meeting that we had. But you see the issue areas of roundtable discussions on no-fault auto fraud, on the property insurance fraud, and then just the prosecutors themselves. We had the Hennepin County attorney, a lead attorney, Emery Adoradio, talking about the major prosecutor offices and how they're organized. If you turn that page, then the second page, and again, these are really current activities, outreach that's really have been, frankly, launched, as I commented, under the leadership and as a result of the leadership of Commissioner Rothman and Mr. Choi. The second one was a unique that I've never seen it. We had a collaborative effort that we did a prosecutor's seminar, insurance fraud prosecutor's seminar, working with Mr. Choi's office, with Bob Hearns, and we had specific issue expertise, and we spent a day. We had six county attorney offices represented here. We had seven prosecutors from the attorney general's office present here, and then a number of insurance industry SIU expertise. So that's, Mr. Chairman and committee members, just to demonstrate the commitment to the collaborative effort and the helping each other get smarter about how do we work together. If you'll turn then the next part of that handout, and it was important for me that the committee see that we are acting on a current basis in Minnesota and passing laws where appropriate to combat some of these areas. And the next one is a copy of Chapter 255 from the 2012 session laws. And that is, as some of you may remember, if you were here, This was a collaborative effort, an agreed-to reform bill between the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, the industry, and the Minnesota Chiropractors Association, MCA. Senator Gazelka was the chief author. Representative Abler was the chief author in the House. And this reform bill passed unanimously, 129 to nothing in the House and 64, 65 to nothing in the Senate. But it specifically targeted deceptive advertising by healthcare providers under our no-fault system. And so it was worked out, negotiated, a series of meetings, including meetings with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, because the second section of that bill is targeted changes to the current criminal code dealing with the crime of runners and cappers. So that's healthcare providers paying people to bring people in for treatment and in a fraudulent sense. So it's just an example of action on a current basis. But where the parties have gotten together, and Mr. Chairman and committee members, I've been coming to this table for a fair number of years.
Mr. Kazoka.
And that's the first time that we've had an agreement between two major interest groups who normally have kind of fought up here on a year in and year out basis.
Senator Kazoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, because you had an insurance agent and a chiropractor in the legislative bodies that decided to agree on something. But, Mr. Johnson, I think it would be good for the committee if you'd flesh out what it is about Minnesota's no-fault laws that are creating a greater potential for fraud or abuse. I mean, because I know one of your sheets, or it's the next presentation, shows dramatic increases in Minnesota. And I think it would be good for the committee. There's a lot of new people here to explain some of that briefly.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, and committee members, just briefly, and this would warrant a considerable discussion and time, but I would say this, that the law that we have in Minnesota today, the no-fault auto law, passed in 1974, effective in 1975, has not been changed or amended in that kind of that box about health care coverage. I think maybe never, or minor changes, if at all. And frankly, I would describe that the no-fault law and the medical coverage sections as being very deficient and not containing any modern medical cost controls. And so that statute requires the payment of services and treatment that I would describe. And I think it's an invitation to perpetrators of fraud to come to a state if their no-fault law is kind of structured in the way that ours is, because you could compare it with a number of other laws that have had provisions in them that specifically deal with the care, medical care, and treatment. So our law is exceptionally vague in its definitional boxes, and I think because of that, in particular, has invited a lot of the abuse that we're seeing today. So with that, just on the last couple sheets of that handout, Mr. Chairman and committee members, if the next one, I put in just the first page. So if you see the United States District Court, District of Minnesota, a piece of paper, and I put that in just as kind of the last chapter, if you will, of the 2012 law that you all passed unanimously. And that law went into effect on January 1, 2013. But there was a lawsuit. A preliminary injunction or injunctive relief was sought by an out-of-state healthcare provider challenging that 2012 law as an impairment or a restriction on the free speech, commercial free speech of providers. And this memorandum, opinion, and order, I would just, if committee members want to read 50 pages of a federal district judge in Minnesota in detail analyzing the legislative intent in passing that Chapter 255 and analyzing in detail the advertisements of the provider who was involved, the plaintiff of the suit. I won't try to summarize it, but I can assure you that what the federal district judge ruled against the effort to get a preliminary injunction, so the matter is still there. But I would just shorten the description to say, the federal district judge found that a lot of those advertisements, newspaper, radio, TV, were in fact deceptive advertising. And deceptive advertising is not commercially protected free speech. And so with that, I will, and Mr. Chairman, I did have a picture at the end just to indicate insurance fraud, and as Commissioner Rothman showed, this is an issue in the media's attention, as there was a KSTP story on organized crime rings in Minnesota just a few weeks ago. And Mr. Lynch will be presenting some information. So I just want the committee to know this is an issue before the public. There's interest in it. It has an enormous consumer impact, and it's worth our time and effort. And, Mr. Chairman, we're committed to, with you and the committee, the laws that we have passed through the years, I'll end with this, is that we have a strong history in Minnesota of passing insurance fraud laws. I don't think any of them that I've been associated have been anything other than bipartisan, and if not unanimously passed by the House and the Senate, whatever their composition, it's been close to unanimous passage, and I think that's an important statement about the commitment to fight this crime. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, this is a good, I think this is a pretty good handout. This one talks about unnecessary treatments.
It's coming up.
Different, pardon? Well, that's, I'm way ahead of time.
Yes.
I'm usually ahead of people. All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anybody, any questions? Okay, now we're going to hear from, is it Bradley Doty or?
It is.
Okay, welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name again is Brad Doty. I'm a partner at the law firm of Stemple and Doty. We primarily work with insurance companies and special investigation units regarding questionable claims. I've been working with Rick Stemple for 15 years, and Rick was working in the fraud arena for 10 years before that. I've been asked today, actually I'm filling in for Rick Stemple. He went up north over the weekend and went in the ditch last night, so I got a phone call this morning that I should be here, but I wanted everyone to know that Rick went in the ditch.
We don't want to put in no fraudulent claims from Mr. Stemple about that accident.
So in that regard, then, I have provided a kind of a handout here today. This is I think there are 12 pages. This is an excerpt of the slide that was shown at the fraud meeting that you mentioned, Mr. Chair. And I've taken, a dozen of those slides that I thought would be most pertinent to kind of just, let the committee members know what we are seeing out there. Fraud has kind of changed and kind of morphed over the years. What we deal with mostly now is different than what it was, 10 years ago, even in terms of, the staged auto accidents and the treatment being rendered that is not necessary. And I think there was a question earlier regarding how come that happens here in Minnesota. And I mean, the No-Fault Act in Minnesota does provide for $20,000 in medical benefits and then $20,000 in wage benefits. And that's pretty prolific in terms of the amounts offered. There are other states that have no-fault, acts, but I think Kentucky it's $10,000. Florida, it's a little more, and Michigan is unlimited. So you think we have problems here. Michigan's even worse. I'm going to just jump right into the handout that I've got here. And the first page of that handout is just kind of touches on some of the advertisements and some of the things that are out there in terms of the Minnesota accident hotlines that you will see. I'll just touch on a couple. The one in the upper left-hand corner is the 1-800-411-PAIN. When you call that phone number, you're always referred to the same set of lawyers and also the same chiropractic clinic. It's couched as a marketing, company, but it's really owned by the specific chiropractor's office. In the upper right-hand corner, I think that's my favorite slide of all, where the car is running into the dollar sign, and then you have the man in the middle with fanning out the dollar bills. And in Spanish, it does say, obtain dollars for your accident. In that particular one, what was happening is that if you were involved in a car accident, and again, Spanish-speaking individuals were being targeted, you would call this helpline, and a representative from the helpline would come to the accident scene, would ask if you were injured, and oftentimes we had testimony where the person said, I just wanted my car fixed. But the person kind of convinces them that they, might be injured. If you're not injured today, you might be tomorrow. In any event, everyone would then go to the victim's home, eventually a chiropractor and a lawyer would show up at the house. So within an hour of two of the accident, there's a claim being made and a lawsuit being commenced. So that's my favorite one. And then in the lower right-hand corner, you've got the 1-800-ESK, Gary, that I think we're all familiar with. Turning the page, I've also just indicated briefly here that what we see when we kind of look behind these clinics and the folks that are in charge of them is that they do migrate from the East Coast, typically New Jersey, New York, that sort of thing, and then down into Florida. And again, they're following the no-fault, money. And then from Florida to Minnesota, I know Colorado used to have a no-fault, used to have no-fault in Colorado. When they did away with their no-fault act, we had a lot of clinics come from Colorado to Minnesota. And again, it's just following the essentially the easy pickings of the no-fault act. The next slide.
Just a clarification is that Ask Gary, is that Senator Dames? We're just discussing that up here. We weren't sure. But, all right, continue on.
Thank you. On the third page of the materials, we put in some information regarding, it says other trends there, but this is an ongoing investigation and a fairly recent investigation that our office has been involved in. And what we've discovered is, in particular because last year was kind of a slow weather year, there weren't enough accidents. So now we've got folks out there that are staging automobile accidents, and the testimony we have from an informant indicates that he was paid, $600 to rent the U-Haul. The person that paid him the $600 caused damage to the vehicle the night before. The next day, he's in a U-Haul, and they stage an automobile accident with another car with four people in it. They all submit insurance claims. He also states that he participated again as an occupant in one of the vehicles. And as the occupant in the vehicle, he only made $300, but he got to keep any settlement that arose out of the ensuing litigation. That's the kind of the staged auto accidents that we're in the midst of now. We also get the jump-in accidents, and that's a term that's been around forever, and I think it's relatively self-explanatory. There might be an accident with one person in each car, but by the time the insurance claims come in, there's four people or three people in each car. The next page is just a summary of some testimony relative to what we could call billing for services not rendered. And what we end up doing when we take statements under oath is we ask exactly what kind of treatment the individual received. And we've got the bills and the CPT codes right next to us, and we ask them. And I, when I'm asking these questions, I even lead them. I try to get them to, maybe they don't understand all the treatment they're getting. So I lead them to help them answer these questions, and they just will say, no, I did not receive that treatment. Well, you can see on the next page here, then the insurance company gets a bill, and the first line of this bill is an intake record, but even if you don't count that, the rest of the bill adds up to $275. And maybe the person testified that they only received about $100 or $150 worth of that treatment. And that, unfortunately, is not unusual. We see that a lot. We also, on the next slide, we see what we consider pattern and practice type of treatment. And the pattern and practice type of treatment is also not unusual at all. When you go see a chiropractor, and if you get enough sampling of insureds and claimants, it doesn't matter how old they are, it doesn't matter what sex they are, it doesn't matter. They all receive the identical diagnoses, and they all receive the identical treatment for about the same amount of time. And the same amount of time is when their no-fault benefits are running out. Also, we've also been involved in cases where the chiropractors, the individual chiropractors, have been told, you will provide what's called a 5+2. I guess that's on the next page. What's called a 5+2 or a 5+1 treatment protocol or formula. And what that means is the 2 refers to the adjustments. When you get your neck and your back cracked, One adjustment could be the entire spine. The second adjustment is an extra spinal adjustment, leg, elbow, something like that. And then also five other modalities. Those five other modalities are all sorts of things like massage, traction, electrical muscle stimulation, ultrasound, things that are considered passive in nature and are just used to really create a large medical bill. This particular clinic, we see bills in the range of $395 per visit, and they go four times a week for a couple of weeks and three times a week. You can see why the no-fault benefits are used up in a hurry. And that's the perfect segue into the next bit of information here. Here's what we have found in our investigation of these clinics. As we talk to individual claimants that, quite frankly, have legitimate injuries, maybe to their knee or a shoulder, I provided here a rotator cuff injury is the first one, where this person had a legitimate rotator cuff injury. It was even noted in the records with the chiropractor from shortly after the accident. However, he never was referred to a specialist, continued to receive multiple passive modalities from the chiropractor, and eventually $18,000 of his medical benefits were used up, and he needed $10,000 to get the shoulder surgery. So again, now he's going to live with a shoulder, legitimate shoulder problem, because he doesn't have the benefits to get it fixed. One more example on this page, just because it was kind of sad, because this person, from the first record, he had struck his teeth on the steering wheel in the car at the time of the accident, and from the first record, there was talk about the necessity of a referral to a dentist or someone to get his teeth fixed. By the time we talked to him, his teeth were gone, and so were his medical benefits. So again, that's kind of what happened in that case. The next page, real briefly, this is just an example of even when the cases get settled, if there is a lawsuit or the insurance company settle a case, here's some of the information that was presented to us. Some insureds or some claimants came to us and said, hey, after all of this, you can see that the chiropractor and the attorney is getting the money, not the claimant or the injured victim. Okay, one or two more examples, and then I'll finish up. But I do think it's important to talk about what we see termed here as spinning. And again, that's the term that the runners or the cappers use themselves. And what spinning means is if you're a runner and you get to an accident scene, you talk to someone that's injured, and you take that person to a chiropractor. The chiropractor pays a kickback to the runner, who oftentimes passes that on to the insured victim. Well, spinning means you go collect from this chiropractor, then in a week or two you go to another chiropractor, and then in a week or two you go to another. And what we find, and it's kind of spelled out here, is that we'll receive bills from three different chiropractors where this guy treated, you know, the same time on both dates. The initial intake a record is a $200 fee or $200 bill. Now we've got three of those to deal with because you went to three different ones. So one caveat is when we talk to these folks, they say, well, wait a minute. Once I stopped at this chiropractor and started at this chiropractor, I never went back to this guy. And we say, well, how come we continue to get bills from this guy? My opinion in that regard is that chiropractor paid out, the going rate is about $1,500. That chiropractor needs to make that back, so he'll keep submitting bills to the insurance company. All right, and that's essentially it. The rest of the slides are sort of encompassed in what I've already talked about, but again, I just wanted to let you know a little bit about what we see when we're out there kind of in the trenches day in and day out. And thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lynch.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Metzen, and thank you for coming to our summit. That was an event that NICB co-hosted with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and rarely do we get a legislator attend, not the least of which would be a committee chairman. So our appreciation for you coming to that.
Mr. Johnson said you better show up, so I did. It was very informative. That's why we're here today.
Thank you. My name is Tim Lynch, Director of Government Affairs at the National Insurance Crime Bureau based in Des Plaines, Illinois. The NICB is a national not-for-profit organization supported by 1,000 property and casualty insurance companies, including many who write business here in Minnesota.
The NICB partners with insurers and law enforcement agencies to facilitate the identification, detection, and prosecution of organized criminal conspiracies dealing with insurance fraud and vehicle theft. We have two investigative field agents who work here in Minnesota, and one of them is with us here today. His name is Don Howell, the good-looking guy here in the back.
That guy? He is very handsome, yeah.
Bottom line is an analysis of an insurance industry questionable claim referrals to the NICB from Minnesota indicates, not to repeat some of the things that have been mentioned here today, but a gross increase in the number of questionable claims related to billing for services not rendered, overzealous solicitation of patients, and exaggerated injury leading to grossly inflated billings. Additional problem areas include staged auto accidents and collusion between fraudulent medical providers, lawyers, and runners hired to funnel unsuspecting claimants. Minnesota's no-fault system has been hijacked by dishonest medical providers, paid intermediaries, and unscrupulous attorneys who have turned the system into their own personal treasury. A few data nuggets. Medical fraud submissions to the NICB from Minnesota have risen by 30% over the last 3 years, with significant upticks in bodily injury and PIP claims. Minnesota ranks number 5 nationally in the average amount of a no-fault claim, that being $9,000, trailing only Michigan, Florida, New Jersey, and New York. Specific and notable increases in chiropractic overbilling, as Brad mentioned, are being seen here as well. A recent report NICB devoted to studying organized criminal activity showed an over 200% increase in questionable claims here in Minnesota. Minnesota ranked number 10 in the gross number of these claims, but the uptick was significant. It deserves mention that NICB collected in 2010 91,000 questionable claims nationwide. In 2012, we just learned that number is 116,000. Bottom line is, this problem is getting worse, and it's getting worse across the country. But there's some specific things we're seeing here, which I think led us to have this hearing here today. Again, as Brad mentioned, NICB data and investigations are showing a reverse migration phenomena observed in organized criminals that focus on PIP fraud. Criminals from states such as Florida and New York are displacing to states such as Minnesota. Criminal enterprises here have clear ties to organized crime in Eastern Europe and Russia. The main area of the state affected is right here in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And as Brad mentioned, we are seeing some victimization of vulnerable citizens as well as minorities from people who've had their benefits exhausted by overbilling when they have legitimate injuries that need treatment. So we are seeing some real consumer protection things here, I think, that need to be addressed. As the chairman attended, we had a fraud summit here in Minnesota in October. We only have one summit per year across the country, and we picked Minnesota. The purpose of this meeting was to identify the scope of the fraud problems here, their impact on consumers, and how we can get at some solutions. Over 200 people attended the summit. We expected about 125, so you eclipsed what we thought we'd get. I attached, for the record, in my testimony here, some things that came out of the summit. I commend the legislature, as Bob did, on passing the runner and capper statute in 2012. Some other states have struggled to do that, so my appreciation to you on doing that. That's one thing that needs to be done and was done. But some additional legislative and regulatory controls are outlined here. I'll just speak to a few of them. Number one are some treatment parameters to determine medical necessity. Two, a fee schedule system which would mirror your workers' compensation system. Three, fair dispute resolution. Four, a fair and neutral arbitration process for no-fault claims. Five, tightened clinic oversight. Six, decertification of fraudulent medical providers. And finally, a civil remedy provision as part of the insurance fraud statute. But know this, all the laws on the books are really not all that meaningful unless they have good, strong enforcement and prosecution as part of that system. And so we are enormously supportive and grateful that you have Mike Rothman, Bob Hearns, John Choi, Mike Freeman. They are a huge part of this team, and we appreciate the support that you've given them. With that, we just appreciate the committee taking the time here today to talk about this issue. Rarely does a committee talk about insurance fraud and insurance fraud only at the state level. So consider yourself unique. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Kosoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the outlined possible directions, we did try to work on a number of those last year, but we couldn't get complete buy-in. Aligning work comp or to the work comp system, would have definitely put parameters in there that I thought we should do that, but that wasn't where we were at. But I have one question related to, I believe Florida put a cap on soft tissue claims of $2,500. And I'm just wondering if you have seen any feedback from that as far as fraud trends. Are they different from Minnesota? What are the results that they had there?
I think because I think that was a relatively recent fix. We haven't quite seen the results of that yet. But a lot of the same problems in Florida are being suffered here. But I can drill down and talk to our people there and get back to you with an answer on that, and I'll be glad to do so.
Okay. Senator Kosoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one unrelated question, because I think you guys are all done. One of the areas that we see, or at least I saw a lot of fraud or potential fraud, was after a large storm, so more on the homeowner side. Can you guys address what could create potential possibilities for fraud when you have a major storm blow through an area?
What you'll see is after a storm is you'll see people who claim to be a public adjuster and who will falsely represent themselves as working for an insurance company, who will then pocket ask for money for a service. Say I'm with Farmers, I'm with State Farm, and then what happens is they take your money and they disappear. And they're very savvy about following the storms. So we saw several states, yours among them, that tried to tackle that. So go ahead, Bob.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Johnson. Yes.
If I can just piggyback on Mr. Lynch's comment to respond to Senator Gazelka. I think the other thing we see, and actually at the summit there was a panel, and sitting behind me is Mr. Charlie Dernberger, who is one of the head of enforcement individuals at our Department of Labor and Industry, and he was on the panel. Helped address some of the aftermath, which is frankly the aggressive out-of-state contractors who will flood into an area and aggressively door knock and start replacing roofs. And this legislature actually has been very good in the last three successive years to pass targeted legislation and working collaboratively together with the insurance and contractor community and the agency. We try to pass some laws that have passed laws that try to target that specific kind of behavior. But it's a phenomenon, Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, that's found around the country and needs a legislative response. So we're going to remain vigilant to see if there's anything left to do in that area.
Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the reason why I think this is important is in the end, these affect people's rates. And if we can work on addressing the major causes of fraud, we're going to drive down the cost of insurance in Minnesota, and that would be a win for everyone.
That's good. Excellent point. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doty or Mr. Lynch, Mr. Choi talked about identity theft as one of the problems. When we're talking about these false claims, do you see a correlation between identity and synthetic identities within these claims?
Lynch.
From our standpoint, I'd have to do some research on that and talk to our investigative people. I'd be happy to get back to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator, from my perspective, we don't necessarily deal a lot with the stolen identities per se. What we end up with is individuals with multiple identities just by changing their names around and things of that nature and a lot of aliases and assumed names. But not true identity theft, I think.
And those are some of the synthetic identities that I'm thinking of from the banking industry.
Oh, okay, sure. So, yes, we do see some of that.
It's helpful, I think, as a start of a roadmap here for your recommendations, how to go forward. So that's helpful to this committee, I think. And be honest with you, I don't think we're going to make huge inroads this session in this area. But we're going to be looking at it very closely over the interim and come back. We're going to come back with some concrete, solid ideas to in this area, because there are a lot of concerns out there. And I, as chair, really am concerned in this area about the driving costs of our insurance in the state. So we're going to be looking at it, and I'm not sure how it's going to be structured, but I've got a couple of committee members here that are in the industry, and I want them to be part of the discussion. So, but we're gonna figure that out. And I've talked to a couple of the House members, and they agree with me. So, anyway, thanks everybody for showing up today. And I think we have one more, Mr. Jim Avery, a retired CEO of Prudential Life Insurance Company. Welcome,
thank you,
to Minnesota Commerce Committee in the Senate.
Yeah, I can start. Save you on the building.
Good afternoon. Who's here? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, and I want to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to update you on STOLI fraud today. STOLI is a fraud. We've heard a lot about the P&C side. STOLI is a fraud that occurs on the life insurance side of the ledger, and it's very harmful to consumers and seniors. STOLI, which is not the vodka, I don't want anyone to have any false pretenses that we're going to talk about that today, is stranger-originated life insurance, and it occurs when investors recruit and finance seniors to purchase life insurance policies, not to protect their loved ones, but solely for the purpose to sell the policies to investors who then collect the death benefit. STOLI policies violate state insurable interest laws, which require that anyone who takes a life insurance policy out on anyone else must have an interest in the continued life and well-being of that person. I think the public policy behind that is probably obvious. My husband and I have life insurance policies on each other, and there are times when that is pretty tenuous. But the idea is you're not supposed to take out a life insurance policy on anyone else that you don't have an interest in their continued life in. Otherwise, the courts here in Minnesota and nationwide have found that that's considered an illegal contract, an illegal wagering contract or wagering on human life. Now, STOLI cannot occur without fraud, because you cannot take a life insurance policy out on someone for the purpose of selling it to someone else. So it inherently involves fraud, but it also involves often falsifying financial records, falsifying health records, and the way it and falsifying finally the financing of the policy itself. And the way it generally works is that STOLI promoters will find seniors and either give them a financial inducement or offer them free insurance for a couple of years, and then have them apply for the policy for the purpose of selling it back. In Minnesota, in 2009, we passed very strong anti-STOLI measures, as have about 42 other states. And since that time, we've seen a decline in STOLI, but it is still around. And as insurance companies, as we have gotten better at detecting the complex fraud on the front end, the STOLI promoters have gotten better at hiding it from us. And especially since we're talking about very large policies, we're talking $1 million to $20 million policies, there's a lot of money to buy a lot of sophistication in hiding the fraud on the front end. I have with me today Jim Avery, who's the very recently retired CEO of Prudential, and he has spent a lot of time protecting Prudential's policyholders from STOLI. And whereas when I am recently retired, I hope to be on a beach, he is very graciously traveling around the country and helping protect consumers from STOLI. He has some great examples of some actual STOLI fraud to share.
Welcome to...
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for giving me this opportunity to be here today. I actually left the beach in Barbados to get here, so that just shows probably why I retired. But with that said, you know, the reward, especially in life insurance, because the policies are so large and the premium is so low in relation to it, the reward is so great. And as you heard from some other testimony today, that generally the penalty is either non-existent or very limited, because there appears to be no victim after the fact, especially if it's discovered early where the transaction is undone. I'll just relate to two examples and then handle any questions you have. First one that you may have read about in the papers was a policy was submitted for application to Prudential from Ohio. So a woman applied for a $9 million life insurance policy. The financials that were submitted with it purported that she had a $12 million net worth and a very high annual income.
Luckily, through our investigation, as this policy was being underwritten, we discovered the facts to be very different. In fact, one, we discovered that while she lived in Ohio, she was driven to Pennsylvania to sign the application. This speaks to the sophistication. Ohio has an anti-Stolle bill, as does Minnesota, and Pennsylvania did not. So they were trying to make the transaction legal. The more troubling facts are that the woman and her husband had a monthly income of $950 and a net worth of $2,000. When we met with the husband and wife and disclosed that they were buying a $9 million policy, they did not know the size, and she became very worried about, quite frankly, her personal safety, knowing that if this policy had been issued by Prudential, she was worth $9 million dead and not very much alive. That is an example of a Stolle policy, and this is one of hundreds that I could tell you. The other one is a little bit more famous, and later in the year you may hear about it because it's probably the cause of some legislation that might come in front of the committees here. And this has to do with a woman in Florida who purchased a $10 million policy from Prudential. The case is referred to by the name of the agent, Brasner case. In this particular case, 3 years after it was issued, we discovered some facts that troubled us, and we did more investigation. Keeping in mind, we try to investigate these things as best we can before they're issued, but the degree of fraud is quite sophisticated. The players, some of them are household names that you would not suspect to either be participating directly or indirectly in fraud, but they do. In this particular case, when the woman was under testimony, she agreed that she neither needed $10 million of insurance, neither had the financials that were submitted to us, nor the health that was submitted to us, and didn't have the means to pay the premium on the $10 million policy. Now, one of the things we always look for is, what is the source of the premium, and do you have the means to buy the policy? Because it's not just the first premium. We want to make sure it's affordable to you over the period of time until death. It turns out that a major firm, that would be a household name here, actually sent the money to her bank, and then the bank issued us a cashier's check as if it came from her account, not the provider, the investor. This is the type of frauds going on, and again, it's very sophisticated. This fraud is, one, hard to detect, but even harder to prove, as is most fraud. And therefore, a number of these cases do get through the system, and they become extremely costly to consumers. So while I might be here, and you may see me as representing the insurance industry, as is stated with other fraud, the cost eventually wind up on the backs of consumers. And in the case of life insurance, because it's generally senior citizens we're talking about, it's going to become not only less affordable, but less available, because the amount of checking and fraud checks that we need to do in the front is very expensive. And therefore, you're going to have less availability and less affordability to those who may need it most. I'm going to stop with those two examples, and we're glad to take any questions you might have.
Any questions of the witnesses? Any other? Okay, you're dismissed.
Thank you.
Okay, you know, let me just
make sure the audience that sometimes
we have a little fun in this committee, but we take this work very seriously, and this is a very issue that we have to tackle, and it's a very serious issue. So anyway, we're not meeting Wednesday. We will continue this conversation on February the 18th, and then we're going to, if we have any bill introductions at that time to this committee, we'll look at those. So with that, the meeting's adjourned.